Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do vaccines have to do with how we understand disease? The stunning success of immunization campaigns against killer infections like smallpox and polio spurred scientists to target other diseases like measles and hepatitis and cervical cancer and a host of others. And as my guest will explain, the widespread adoption or rejection of new vaccine formulas throughout history has been determined not only by medical research, but also by law, marketing, social class, and culture. Elena Conis is assistant professor of history at Emory University. Her new book is called Vaccine Nation, America's Changing Relationship with Immunization. Elena, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much.
So American children in particular have never received as many vaccines as they do today. How has the list of what's recommended or required grown over the years?
Well, interestingly, it's changed in two important ways. One is simply in terms of the number of vaccines that we now require for children at a fairly young age. But secondly, if you look at what I call the modern era of vaccination, the period that really begins in the 1960s and follows us up until today, the types of vaccines that we're requiring for children have changed significantly. And in the 1960s, we added a number of vaccines to the childhood schedule against diseases and infections like measles, mumps, and rubella. And at the time, those were infections and diseases that were considered, and I'm quoting scientists from the time, they considered them, quote, mild. And so to use vaccines against these diseases was very different from how vaccines had been used before the 1960s against infections like smallpox, polio, and diphtheria, which were considered real deadly infections and which prompted a lot of fear among the public in general. So one way that I like to capture the difference in vaccination in this modern era versus the previous era is that after the 1960s, vaccination was no longer just about preventing death. It was also about optimizing life and making life more comfortable, more convenient, more livable.
Even the use of vaccines and how they were applied has changed a lot. For a while, vaccines would be recommended when a community had an outbreak of a particular illness, and then they became sort of a standard preventive that was given, theoretically, should be given to every child.
Yes, yes. And that, too, is something that starts to shift in the 1960s. And again, if you look at that period before the 1960s, when we vaccinated against smallpox and polio and diphtheria and pertussis, it was generally in the context of epidemics, situations in which suddenly the levels of these infections were skyrocketing out of control and city or county health departments or sometimes state health departments swooped in and said, everybody's got to get vaccinated. In the 1960s, increasingly, we were vaccinating proactively. There was a lot of experimentation with that before the 1960s, but in the 60s, a couple of important things happened. And one was that we had just gotten the whole country on board with polio vaccination, and people seemed willing to vaccinate proactively against polio. They dreaded the epidemics of polio that had happened in the 40s and 50s, and they got their children vaccinated during those times of epidemics, but they also got their children vaccinated in quiet, healthy times to prevent those future epidemics. And so scientists at the Centers for Disease Control, or CDC, started to say, we should start to vaccinate against other diseases this way, too. For instance, we now have this new vaccine against measles. Let's do the same thing with measles. Let's vaccinate proactively and make vaccination a kind of permanent part of childhood preventive medicine. President Kennedy got on board with this idea in the 1960s, too, and helped pass legislation that made this proactive approach to immunization a kind of permanent feature of federal immunization law as well.
And that went hand in hand with the Kennedy administration beginning the fight that would later be taken up to a greater extent by the Johnson administration against poverty. Can you talk a little bit about the long-time association between infectious disease and poverty or lower social class?
Yes, absolutely. One thing that most people who study the history of medicine know is that we, and I mean humans in general, have a long history of pinning the blame for epidemics on society's outcasts or society's most impoverished members. And if you look, for instance, at the history of outbreaks of cholera in New York City in the 19th century, very often it was the poor who were thought to be carrying that disease into the city and helping it spread throughout the city. And this is something that, interestingly and not surprisingly, comes into play in the discourse around measles vaccination in the 1960s. We vaccinated against measles in the 1960s because measles was a disease that was just as bad, if not worse, than polio, and suddenly we had a means of preventing it. But what scientists at the time also realized was that vaccination, whether it be against polio or against measles, was largely being taken up by the middle class. And suddenly, it became obvious that there were large pockets of unvaccinated people largely living clustered in low-income communities. And part of Kennedy's support for vaccinating, giving Americans access to vaccination against measles, was to address this disparity in terms of class access to vaccination. But what happened at the same time was that the scientists who then set out to say, and the public health officials who set out to say, okay, let's get everybody vaccinated, when poor communities didn't jump on board with vaccination as quickly as the middle class had, often these poor communities were blamed for not caring about vaccination, for not prioritizing it, for not realizing how important these diseases were and how their vulnerability was a threat to the community at large.
So at the point at which we made vaccines almost like a birthright, something that would not be denied regardless of income to children in this country, then we re-stigmatized those who happened to get sick anyway.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened, interestingly enough. And I don't think that anybody set out with bad intentions. Yeah. I think that when this process began in the 1960s, it was really with the best of intentions and out of a sense of altruism, although Kennedy's support for providing states with the funds and the resources to promote immunization widely also was kind of backed by a number of political goals that he had in mind. But that aside, there was pure altruism behind this, I believe. And yet at the same time, as soon as it became clear that these infections were clustered in these non-immunizing communities, there was a stigma associated with it. You are to blame for still being vulnerable to this infection and keeping this infection alive.
Why was there a delay in uptake in those communities if vaccinations were provided at low cost or no cost?
That's a really good question. And as a historian, you go back in time and you try to find as many voices as you can. And I had a hard time finding the voices of the members of these communities in particular. And so I had to some extent, try to piece together what was going on. A lot of what I saw in the archives of the Centers for Disease Control, where I saw lots of paperwork from these campaigns, for example, was there are challenges to reaching these communities because both parents work during the day, or sometimes they work at night, or they don't have a telephone, or they keep odd schedules, or it's not safe to go into those communities and knock on doors and tell people now's the time to get vaccinated against polio or measles or whatever the campaign of the day was. So I think that's part of it. I also think, and this is something that a number of historians have shown in a number of contexts, that to some extent, you know, to be on board with vaccination, it has to be a priority. The prevention of the target disease has to be a priority for you and your community. And this wasn't always the case. For the middle class, who, you know, whose members were already on board with taking their children to the doctors routinely, proactively, from a very young age, that was kind of a class-based luxury that many poor communities in the 1960s didn't have. And that was one more barrier to, you know, getting access to these vaccines.
It's really fascinating to consider that situation in the 1960s in contrast with what we have today, in which advocates of universal vaccination will say it is often easier in lower education, lower income communities to sort of get people who take their kids to the doctor to listen to the advice of the doctor than it is in some more highly educated communities that are starting to push back against against compulsory vaccines.
Yeah, I think that is really interesting. And yet I also think that our understanding of this is perhaps a little bit oversimplified. And if you look at the statistics today on who's getting vaccinated and who's not, or who's getting fully vaccinated and who's not, it is the case that, first of all, I think it's still less than 1% of American children who are lacking all vaccines. So 99% of children are well vaccinated. And within that 1%, there still is a significant portion of that fraction is comprised of low-income members of our society. And yet, at the same time, we hear a lot about these middle, upper middle class enclaves of non-vaccinators or vaccine resistors, people who feel empowered, I would say no to their doctors or question the medical advice that they're being given, or, you know, finding ways around the state laws and regulations that require vaccines for their children. So it's true that there is a kind of class differential in terms of who feels empowered to speak back against these vaccine recommendations we have today.
Are we just hearing more about these people to a disproportionate extent because they tend to be the people who, you know, have control over the media and know people who have a bully pulpit?
Yeah, I think there are a number of reasons why we're hearing more about these people. I think it's a kind of compelling and interesting media story, and it's a new one. It's one we haven't had before or heard before. You know, the story of low-income people still lack access to vaccines doesn't necessarily make for compelling headlines. I'm sorry to say that it's quite cynical, but I think it's true. I also think that if you look closely at a lot of the reporting about these communities of vaccine refusers, they're not just news stories about vaccine refusers or people with vaccine hesitancy. They're news stories about moral judgments, kind of moral judgments of who's a good parent and who's a bad parent in this society. And I don't necessarily think it's about who's in control of the media, because often these people who are choosing not to vaccinate or not to fully vaccinate their children or not to vaccinate their children on schedule are portrayed in a fairly harsh light. And a lot of the reporting that I've looked closely at focuses almost exclusively on mothers, often stay-at-home, non-working mothers, often very educated white mothers as well, who feel like they have done the research and have the power to make this decision, the decision that they feel is best for their children. But the reporting on these mothers comes with a judgment. You don't know what's best for your child, or you think you know what's best for your child, but it's selfish and it ignores the rest of the needs of the community, because by not vaccinating your child, you're putting other children and other members of your community at risk. So I think, in a way, that's been such a compelling media story because it carries that level of moral judgment with it.
My guest is Elena Conis. She's assistant professor of history at Emory University and author of the new book Vaccine Nation, America's Changing Relationship with Immunization. If you'd like to jump in on this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Assistant Professor of History at Emory University, Elena Conis. Her new book is called Vaccine Nation, America's Changing Relationship with Immunization. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Elena, if you think about it, even if you see that people who get vaccinated don't get sick and people who don't get vaccinated sometimes get sick, the idea behind it is, you know, it involves a lot of things that make people uncomfortable, right? There are needles and there's like the injection of this foreign agent into the body. Can you talk a little bit about how World War II helped to build a case for mass vaccination campaigns and helped get people comfortable with the idea of this thing?
Sure. I think the war played a role in a number of ways. First and most immediately was the sense of patriotism that Americans had during the war. And when, for instance, just after the war, there was a threat of an outbreak of smallpox, Americans felt it was their patriotic duty to line up, listen to the decrees coming from their health departments, and get vaccinated for the good and the strength of the country. There were also a number of research efforts during the war to develop new vaccines for diseases that were affecting the troops. And it was during the war that, for instance, research on vaccines against measles and mumps accelerated to a great degree. And Americans heard these stories in the radio reports and in the newspaper stories that they listened to and read about the war. And this vaccine development was part of a kind of bigger narrative about how U.S. science and technology was so wonderful, was so impressive, was helping Americans win the war, was helping Americans become the leader of the free world. So vaccines got kind of written into this narrative about American exceptionalism, if you will, and helped create an environment that primed Americans to get on board and get vaccinated in that period just after the war.
How did it happen that the emphasis on universal vaccination went to small children?
That's really interesting, and there are a number of ways that I can answer it, and I'll highlight two. One of them is the fact that pediatric care really starts to kind of come into existence in the late 19th century, but is sort of solidified as a normal component of middle-class child-rearing by, say, the 1920s, 1930s, and children are being taken to the doctor routinely to get weighed, to have their height measured, to, you know, fill out dietary questionnaires. And this is a reasonable setting for administering a number of vaccines. And some of the vaccines that we had in the early 20th century were for infections that preferentially struck children and did the most harm in children, like pertussis, like diphtheria. That wasn't true of tetanus necessarily. It wasn't true of smallpox, for instance. But pediatric care created a kind of a setting in which these children were like a captive audience, and you could administer all of the other tests, give them the vaccines against the childhood diseases, and then give them the other vaccines that it increasingly became apparent adults were less willing to get for themselves. Even though smallpox, even though polio were often recommended to adults, there are so many quotes that I came across in my research of public health experts from the time saying, it is so difficult to motivate these people, let's just vaccinate the children.
There's also that reality that a lot of adults feel rather invincible but feel like their kids are vulnerable.
There is that as well. I think that's very true. And for a lot of the childhood diseases, many adults have already suffered through them and knew what it was like to experience them as children, and also may have acquired immunity because they had those infections as children. And in the 1950s and 1960s, what you see among the American public is a growing intolerance for even these mild infections and the inconveniences they pose. So adults say, okay, I had measles and mumps, and no, maybe it wasn't such a big deal, or maybe it was. It depended on a family's experience, but I don't want my child to go through that. And there were other ways that people began to think about children differently at that time, too, that that also prompted people to vaccinate their children. Children were more vulnerable. They had high hopes about their children's success in school, in the workplace. There was lots of rhetoric about the ability of these mild diseases to, quote, take the edge off a child's intelligence. Well, once you hear that, of course you'll get your child vaccinated against these diseases.
Was that true, or was that rhetoric? Was that hype?
It was a little bit of both. And the story of the mumps vaccine, I think, is so interesting because here's a disease that wasn't necessarily considered a public health priority before the vaccine became available. It was a public health priority in the context of war because if older adolescent males and young adult males had escaped childhood without mumps, they were particularly vulnerable to mumps, and it caused a really painful complication in them, testicular swelling. And in the context of war, that meant that you had sometimes whole infirmaries of men holed up with mumps for sometimes weeks at a time. But after war, mumps was less of a public health priority. There was some scientific attention to it, some isolated reports that it was possibly connected to permanent sterility in males, possibly connected to, and I'm using a scientific diagnosis at the time, quote, mental retardation in children, possibly connected to diabetes, likely connected to deafness. And there was scientific debate about this until the mumps vaccine comes out. And then people begin to revisit all that data, look more closely at it, start to do more studies, see that, okay, it's not entirely clear, but isn't any possibility of a complication worth preventing? So, again, it's part rhetoric and part reality.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. I have a quick question, and I'll take the answer off the air. I have a very close family friend who has six children, two of which reacted adversely to the vaccinations and were actually later in life mentally retarded because of the vaccinations they were required to have. And I was just wondering, the research that was done, I know that the family that was involved, they found a support group, and I guess tens of thousands of people have been affected this way since the 1960s. I'm just wondering, did you find anything in your research with this regard? Is this an occurrence larger than what we expect? And thank you for your time. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks for your question, John. I think that I'm going to go back in time a little to answer this question as well. In the early 1980s, 1982, there was an NBC affiliate station in the Washington, D.C. area that ran an investigative hour-long report called Vaccine Roulette. And the subject of that report was the pertussis vaccine and the evidence in the scientific literature that the pertussis vaccine had been long known to cause inconsolable crying, fevers, sometimes really high fevers, seizures, and sometimes developmental disabilities that appeared to be permanent. And that broadcast sparked a movement of parents who went back, looked closely at that data, and said, yes, it does seem like the scientific community knew that there were these adverse consequences of this vaccine and didn't share that with parents. And so in the 1980s, you have parents saying there are two different stories. There's the stories that are in the scientific literature, and then there are the stories that we're told by our doctors when we bring our children in to get vaccinated. We need more information on these risks. And the scientific community agreed and lent its support to federal legislation that was meant to address this, that was passed in 1986, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. But I think what's more telling is that it was parents who brought this issue to light. But as I looked back and in the course of my historical research, I found that scientists were talking and public health experts at the CDC were talking about these very issues in the 1970s as more and more children were being required to get a whole slate of new vaccines. They were saying, okay, we know that these vaccines come with risks. We don't necessarily know all the risks. We do know some of them. How much of this information do we share, and how do we compensate families who are injured? And that question didn't get addressed until really parents started to press for a solution.
How did it happen that laws were passed, and particularly in school systems, that required most children to be vaccinated? I say most because there have always been some exceptions, but in some states they're easier to get than in others.
Yeah, a lot of those laws, well, some of these laws predate the modern era, the 1960s, but the laws in general get a big push in the 1960s. They get a push from a number of areas. There are a couple of public health studies that show that states that have such laws on the books have fewer epidemics than states that don't. So there's some scientific evidence that these laws are worth putting into effect. There's also federal support from these laws, first from the Kennedy administration, but later there ends up being a tremendous push in the 1970s from the Carter administration. And Carter has his kind of own political aims in supporting childhood vaccination, but one of them is the reduction of skyrocketing health care costs. And so he begins or rolls out a childhood immunization initiative. He puts his Secretary of Health at the helm. And the idea of this initiative is to get every child vaccinated, to give states the funds that they need, but also to call every governor out there and get them to bring their laws up to the same level. And that's the kind of final push that we get at the end of the 1970s, such that by 1980, pretty much every state has laws on the books requiring all of the then recommended childhood vaccines for all kids before school.
Going back to what you mentioned earlier, Elena, about mothers being really the target of a lot of education campaigns that are trying to encourage parents to vaccinate their children, there were different kinds of arguments made, right? There was the you don't want your child to die of something very serious. You don't want your child to be uncomfortable. And then later, as more and more mothers, middle class mothers, were working, there was the argument that, well, you don't want to have to take a week off to take care of a kid who's got the mumps.
Sure. I was so fascinated to stumble across that argument in the archives. And initially, I started this research by going back and looking at the history of polio, which has been well told and often told. And one of the features of that history is that mothers went out into their communities and volunteered their time to encourage other mothers to vaccinate their children. And when the new vaccines came out against measles, for instance, the approach of the national immunization campaigns was get those mothers on board. They're already devoted to the cause. Let's get them on board. But as the disease has shifted, and mumps is such a good example of this because it was considered so mild and there was so much debate at the time about whether we should even be asking parents to vaccinate their children against this disease, increasingly you see an argument that says, well, if mothers are now in the workplace and if having a sick child means that they have to stay home for, you know, 1 week, 2 weeks, maybe 3 or 4 weeks if mumps passes from one child to the next child, this is a matter of convenience and it's a matter of being in the economic interest of the working mother to vaccinate her children against these diseases. That's an argument that gets echoed later on, for instance, with the chickenpox vaccine. We hear it a lot today with the flu vaccine. Of course, it's an argument that assumes that the mother is always going to be the primary caretaker and the one who's going to be staying home to take care of her sick child, but perhaps that's a separate issue.
What role have insurance companies played in all this? Because there are some vaccines for so-called milder illnesses that may be associated with fewer complications and lower, you know, mortality rates that for a while weren't covered and then suddenly they're covered by insurance.
Yeah, and I think that one of the biggest changes has actually come fairly recently under Obamacare, where we suddenly have all of the vaccines recommended by the Centers for Disease Control Immunization Committee. Those vaccines now have to be covered by insurance and they have to be fully covered. And that's fairly new. Before this time, it was up to individual insurance companies to decide which vaccines to cover and when. And some states experimented with laws that required insurance companies to cover certain vaccines. And interestingly, this came into play with the HPV vaccine, which was first approved in this country in 2006. And states initially considered requiring that vaccine for all sixth grade girls, and that was a proposal that turned out to be enormously controversial. And many states ended up changing tack and said, okay, well, let's not require it, but instead let's just require insurance companies to cover the cost of the vaccine for their members who want the vaccine. So the insurance company part of the story has more recent developments. Historically, it was really parents paying out of pocket or federal funds making these vaccines available to people without the means to pay for them.
Do you think the HPV vaccine was so controversial specifically because of its association with what is a sexually transmitted disease?
I think that's one of the main reasons that it was controversial. I think it was also controversial because of the way that it was initially proposed to be mandated, i.e. just for girls and just before they entered sixth grade. I think it was also controversial because the disease that it prevents, or one of the diseases that it prevents, cervical cancer caused by or linked to infection with HPV, that disease had been marketed by the drug company Merck before they rolled out the vaccine. And I think that made consumers extraordinarily skeptical about it. And it was a moment of extreme public skepticism about the drug industry anyway. So there were all these factors that came together to make the HPV vaccine so controversial when it came out. It seems extraordinarily obvious now in retrospect, but at the time, I think a lot of people in the public health community were kind of, you know, raising their arms in disbelief. How is it that this vaccine is so controversial? We've mandated other vaccines for children, and they've been vaccines against diseases that are sexually transmitted, like hepatitis B. So why this one? And I think the answer is it was a constellation of cultural and social forces at that time that led people to be really skeptical of how that vaccine was rolled out.
My guest is Lena Conis. She is assistant professor of history at Emory University and author of the new book Vaccine Nation, America's Changing Relationship with Immunization. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Lena Conis, who's assistant professor of history at Emory University and author of the new book Vaccine Nation, America's Changing Relationship with Immunization. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Elena, I want to talk about the resistance to specifically the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, after the publication of a later discredited report that linked the MMR vaccine with some cases of autism. Given the cultural factors that you say have always been an issue in how vaccines were received or not, did this sort of happen at the perfect or the worst possible moment in terms of the really the growth of the belief that that vaccine directly caused autism?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And when I look back at that story, I see something a little bit different going on. I think that there's become a kind of shorthand for describing what has happened with the public's ideas about the MMR vaccine. And these public worries that we have today about that vaccine are often traced back to that 1998 study published in The Lancet that purported to have found a link between the MMR vaccine and autism in a small sample of children. And yes, it was later discredited. But parental worries about vaccines and a host of learning disabilities, including autism, dated back to the early 1980s. And if you look at a lot of the vaccine skeptical literature from that time, you see these autism worries simmering well before that study comes out. That study, I believe, was actually a consequence of or response to the fact that there was this long simmering worry that had not been addressed. And when it comes out in 1998, a number of longstanding vaccine critics, I'll call them, initially kind of shrug and say, okay, well, yeah, we've been saying that all along, that there appears to be a link between vaccines and autism, so we're not, you know, stunned by this study. But what that study does is that it comes out at a moment when we're also looking at the chemical ingredients in vaccines, and there's enormous controversy over a preservative called thimerosal that contains mercury. And it also comes out at a time when diagnoses and rates of autism start to skyrocket. And it comes out in 1998, and over the subsequent decade, up until today, autism rates just climb and climb and climb and climb. So it's that study really sits at this kind of interesting historical moment. It's responding to everything that has come before, but then it also speaks to something that's about to happen, that is this skyrocketing prevalence of autism and increasing public demand for answers to what's behind this epidemic.
We have an interesting relationship to the healthcare industry as Americans as well. We might very much trust our doctors, but we don't necessarily trust big pharma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that's very true. And that lack of trust, I think that it's actually the seeds of that are sowed at a number of different points and in a number of different ways. And I think today we can say we have quite a bit of faith in physicians. But the origins of contemporary fears about vaccines go back to this period in the 1960s and 70s when certain Americans were questioning authority and authority figures, and doctors were among those. And I think today, you're right, we're more likely to question or doubt the integrity of big pharma in particular. And that has to do with things that also date back to the 60s and 70s. That is, a number of drugs that had been released, promoted, marketed to the public. We were told that they were safe, you know, the birth control pill, the morning sickness drug, DES, Valium, hormonal replacement therapy, come up to, you know, the early 2000s, drugs like Vioxx. These are a number of examples of drugs that the pharmaceutical industry said, these are safe, they're ready for you to use, and then we later found out that they came with serious risks and they either had to be reformulated or pulled from the market entirely. And in the early 2000s, the criticisms of the drug companies in particular just reach a fever pitch. You even have in 2004 the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine writing a best-selling book lambasting the drug companies for just being in it for profits, cutting corners, etc. So in the early 2000s, we hit this moment of extraordinary public doubt and loss of faith in the drug companies. And yes, it is much worse than the erosion of faith in physicians themselves.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Scott in Dallas on the phone. Hi, Scott. Scott, are you with us?
Hey, Chris. Great show. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Actually, we could hear you, and now we can't hear you. Go right ahead, please, Scott.
I just wondered if your guest would comment on the health industry's tendency to always be surprised or point towards customer reaction as the problem rather than to look internally for solutions. Most other industries, when a customer base tends to move away from them, they react in a way that meets those customer concerns more readily than the healthcare industry.
What do you think about that, Elena?
That's an interesting question. I think there's some truth to that claim. I also think that the healthcare industry is enormously broad. I mean, there are the drug companies, there are the insurance companies, there are physicians, and it's hard to kind of generalize about the industry as a whole. But I do think that we are in some ways sort of beholden. I mean, consumers today, for instance, don't have a ton of choice about their insurance company, for example. It's largely determined by their employer. And once they have their insurance company determined, they don't have a ton of choice about their physician. So it's true that we've got a system in which consumers do feel, I think, often a little bit locked in. And, you know, that may be the case with vaccines, too. And there's a broader history to that. With vaccines, we have, you know, limits to our choice based on the state laws and regulations, and increasingly some employer-based laws and regulations around the flu vaccine, for instance. So there's some lack of choice there. There's also the fact that historically a number of drug companies left the vaccine market because it was considered too risky. The risk of lawsuits was too high. The drugs were just too risky. They weren't profitable enough, et cetera. And so in the 1980s, we started to lose vaccine producers and lose, you know, options in terms of, do you want this vaccine or that vaccine? If you had to get the DPT vaccine, there was just one and you had to get it. So I think that that question is worth maybe breaking down into its multiple parts, but I think it is true that we have lost a little bit of choice in this arena.
You talked earlier about the fact that, you know, a lot of well-educated people have come to expect some degree of choice and autonomy in the things that they do to maintain their health, particularly proactively. And I'm wondering if somehow the rub is that this is different, right? It's one thing to make the consumer choice to put your five-year-old in a sweater or a fleece, but if, you know, medical science says this or insists that this is the way that vaccines should happen, we may or may not be qualified to say, actually, I think it should go a different way if we don't have that background.
Yeah, and I think that the growing number of states that had been passing philosophical exemptions were responding to just this, consumers feeling that they wanted more choice in terms of which vaccines to get for their children and which to opt out of or delay. And that press for these philosophical exemptions to state laws came from the extraordinary growth in the vaccine schedule and the incredible variety in the types of diseases that the recommended vaccines now prevent. But I want to say something else about choice, and that is that going back again to the beginning of this era, the 1960s and 1970s, as parents were being encouraged to get these new vaccines, the promotional rhetoric was all about choose this for your child. This is the best for your child. This is the way to ensure the best future and the healthiest upbringing for your child. And this, of course, went alongside with the new laws and the increasing enforcement of those laws. But the rhetoric was, you have the choice to do this for yourself, and it's good for you and your children and your family. And today in the 2000s, we increasingly hear a lot of rhetoric about how vaccination is not just for you. It's for the community as a whole. And that's because once enough people get vaccinated, you protect the entire community because there's no longer enough vulnerable people for an infection to take hold. And I think it's so interesting that this kind of community-based argument comes after decades of us saying, take care of yourself and your children. And a lot of parents who do seem to be questioning or resisting vaccines often say that they're making the decision that feels best for their family or themselves or their individual children. And yes, not for the community as a whole. They're often labeled as selfish, but I think that their response is kind of a natural reaction to decades, if not centuries, of encouraging Americans to take care of their own health first.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Olivia on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Olivia.
Hi. My question is, if we have a history of preventative measures being covered by insurance, such as vaccines, why wouldn't other preventative measures also be covered by insurance?
It's a little outside the scope of the book, but maybe you can speak to this in a general way, Elena.
Yeah, it is beyond my area of expertise, but a lot of other preventative measures are often covered by insurance. And I'm thinking of lots of different types of cancer screenings, for instance, are covered by insurance for the same exact reason. It's a small cost up front to prevent potentially high costs down the road. So vaccines keep company with a number of other preventive measures in that way.
So I'm going to ask you every historian's least favorite question, which is, where do you think we go from here?
I think one of the places that we need to go from here is opening ourselves up to a slightly different conversation. What has happened over the last decade in particular is that this conversation has been stalled by the fact that we have distilled it down to quote-unquote anti-vaccine forces on one hand and pro-vaccine forces on the other hand. And I think that there are a number of vaccination worries and concerns out there that get missed in the noise between these two polarized camps. So I think we need room for more open discourse that accepts and listens to and respects people's vaccination worries. And I also think we need to acknowledge that in this era of vaccination, we have created a cultural idea, the vaccine-preventable disease. And even these diseases that were once considered mild, again, like measles and mumps were in the 1960s, we no longer think of them that way. We create these new entities that are known for their risks and their complications and that are considered public health priorities. So I think it would help to look at the big picture of what vaccination is doing to our conceptualization of disease and think about what our goal is in the long term. What do we want to do with vaccination of children? What is our end goal? Is it the elimination or eradication of every preventable diseases? I don't know if the American public is going to be on board with that. They're certainly going to be on board with the diseases that, you know, they feel moved to prevent. But I think we do need a much broader and more complicated conversation about the overall end goal.
So we continue to balance risk and reward. And of course, it feels most risky to you when you happen to be affected by something directly.
Of course, yeah. And, you know, again, going back to the 1960s, the CDC scientists who were trying to make the case for vaccinating against these mild infections said, all right, parents are going to say, but it's only measles, but it's only mumps. And what we're going to say is, these diseases carry the risk of severe complications, and when those complications happen to your child, the risk is 100%. Interestingly, decades later, vaccine-skeptical parents took that same maxim and turned it on its head. Hmm. The vaccine risks may be very, very rare, but when they happen to your child, they're 100%.
Elena Conis is Assistant Professor of History at Emory University. Her new book is called Vaccine Nation, America's Changing Relationship with Immunization. Elena, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate the invitation.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.